peppers, vinegar, salt. We've all seen the slender bottle with its red cap and distinctive diamond-shaped label waiting next to the salt and pepper shakers at the neighborhood diner. And many of us have, at one time or another, used a drop or two to put some life back into some really bland food. But few of us know the story of what's in that little red bottle. And so today, we're going to open a bottle of Tabasco sauce and pour it all out.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 570th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Puerto Madryn who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards, producer Carol Stafford, and Parmley Taff as well. Folks, I learned about Tabasco sauce while at sea in the Navy. You see, after we had been at sea for a few days, all of our fresh food would have been devoured or spoiled, and there would have been nothing left but preserved foods. And after a few weeks at sea, it seemed like the only thing left with any life in it was that little red bottle of Tabasco sauce. And so we sailors slathered that Tabasco sauce on everything. Eggs, milk, peas, roast beef, anything and everything. Today, Tabasco sauce has become a ubiquitous feature of the American food chain. But this leads us to ask, why is there only one Tabasco sauce? Here to help us find an answer, we have Jeffrey Rothfeder, who is the author of McLanny's Gold. Did I get the name right?
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you.
Good. Welcome aboard. And a fun read. I really enjoyed it, picked it up, and started reading about the history of hot sauce, Tabasco sauce, and I thought there's a lot more here than what meets the eye in that little red jar. What led you to delve into this subject, Jeffrey?
Well, it was pretty prosaic in a sense. I have been looking for years, like everyone else, at Tabasco bottles on diner tables or in my home.
It is ubiquitous, isn't it?
It's everywhere. It's 140 countries, and as you described it in the Navy, well, it's also obviously on cruise ships and often even on airplanes you can get them these days. And yes, the military carries them as well. And so, you know, I'd look at the bottle, and I've been a business journalist for many years, and I often look at the name of the company that makes things. And in this case, it said McElhinney Company, Avery Island, Louisiana, and that just got me to thinking as to who are these guys, and how did they produce a product that everyone knows about all over the world, and they're living on Avery Island, Louisiana? Where is that? You know, and so I just began to look into them, and frankly, I expected them to be, you know, owned by General Foods or Kraft. And,
like everything else is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And then it wouldn't have been a very interesting story, but you start peeling back the layers and you find that this is a 140-year-old family business that does things the way they've always done it from a little island. They don't have factories anyplace else. You know, you just, every single story becomes more intriguing. And so I just delved in and, I spent about two and a half years researching them, and it turned out to be a great story every place I turned.
And it keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper. But it's a family-owned mm-hmm. business, but it does a lot of business, doesn't it?
Yeah. Amazingly, I mean, they do $250 million worth of business around the world. And they started 140 years ago. But what's really intriguing about them is that most companies that do that much business, most food companies, will either outsource part of their, you know, their development to mm-hmm. other companies someplace else, or they will ship from local areas, let's say in Europe or Asia. They're very popular in Asia, for instance, Tabasco sauce is. But not them. I mean, they stick to the one factory, as I said, on Avery Island. They make it the way they used to. They always have made it the same way. And so everything they do has followed this sort of conservative approach to business, which really is the key to their success. They've never gone too far. They've never overspent for equipment they didn't need. They've never gone into markets they shouldn't be in. And so everything they've done is just right, and they've had really good the McElhaney family has had a really good sense about this all along their history.
And it being a 114-year-old family-owned company, there's been a lot of McElhaneys involved, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're now actually in their fourth generation and going into their fifth, and they've always had a McElhaney at the head of the company, except for one brief period in the 90s.
And we'll get into that later. Yeah. But first, I'd like to take you back a little bit and talk about the whole notion of hot foods, mm-hmm. peppers, mm-hmm. spicy foods. I was raised in Montana and really never really discovered spicy foods until I moved south and ran into the Navy and whatnot and ended up in Asia, and wow, it was wonderful. But there seems to be more hot sauce the closer you get to the equator. Is there some reason for that?
Well, it is true that, first of all, chili peppers have been, around forever and ever, and
right.
All Native American tribes have used it one way or the other, although you're absolutely right that you know, the growing areas obviously are closer to the equator. In fact, in the United States, they grow in New Mexico and Arizona, but that's about it. Louisiana, obviously, as well. So much of the country just didn't have access to chilies. But the thing about hot peppers is that they're very addictive, and this is chemically proven. They're addictive. They work on the pain pleasure principle, in that it hurts to eat it, and then you feel a lot of pleasure right afterwards, and you want more of it. And they've been used over the centuries, often as a way to spice up bland food, basically. And much food was bland for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it is really, it's interesting that, especially in the United States, in the past 20, 30 years, with the boom of Tex-Mex food and that sort of thing, hot sauces have really become in vogue. And one reason is, they're very, very healthy. I mean, that's
one of the things you talk about in McElhaney's Gold, is that there was a health reason that people mm-hmm. closer to the equator ate a lot of peppers.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's interesting. There have been scientific studies done on what which people ate a lot of peppers and which didn't. And one of the reasons is, and people didn't know this, but they just, it worked out this way, that people who ate food with chilies did not get sick as much as people who didn't. And so, thus, people continued to eat foods with chilies. And it turns out to be that there is a bacteria-killing part of the chili pepper that really helps.
A significant bacteria-killing function.
Yeah, absolutely. And so people just began to do it because the people that survived longer were those who liked chili peppers, and so it became a part of the diet.
And those that didn't like chili pepper,
right, didn't last as long, which is interesting. And now, of course, you find pepper sauces in lots of health food stores, certainly gourmet food stores, places where good foods are eaten, because it's a very wholesome food. I mean, it's pepper, salt, and vinegar, basically. Tabasco sauce is, and others perhaps are. Some of the peppers are a lot hotter than Tabasco sauce in some of the stuff you'll find in the real hot food stores. But nonetheless, there are people who love chili peppers so much it can't be hot enough, And so
that would
so
be
they've
me,
gotten
I'm
very,
afraid.
Very interested in it.
Some like it hot, and that would be me. Speaking of hot food, tell us a little bit about the Cajun influence on the foods of Louisiana, and mm-hmm. take us back there before the Civil War.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, the great thing about this story, by the way, is that it follows the trail of American history so well, starting from before the Civil War up to now. And so, Louisiana is obviously an amalgam of lots of different kinds of cultures. The French were there, the Spanish were there, Caribbeans were there, and the Caribbean blacks that came up. And the Cajuns, of course, which were French Canadians, came down there when they were kicked out of French Canada. In the early 1800s, and so
for which we are now grateful, right?
Right, for which we're definitely grateful. They brought so much of the Louisiana culture to the state, and one of the things that they did do is bring a way of making foods that was different, because they were kind of the poorer class when they arrived. That was different than some of the richer people, and basically it had to do with just mixing everything into one pot. They had a lot of these one-pot cooking going on with, the jambalayas and
Whereas the rich people did what?
Well, the rich people were preparing, you know, the real French diets and the Spanish diets that they brought from Europe with them, and they would actually teach their their slaves who before the Civil War who were their cooks how to make those kinds of foods. Now, of course, one interesting aspect of that is most of the slaves came from the Caribbean, where they did learn to love spices very early on in their lives. So they would add to the French and Spanish foods some spice and some chili peppers and things like that. And so that got kind of the rich class into eating chili peppers.
Because, of course, it's addictive, right?
Because it's addictive, exactly. Okay. Meanwhile, the Cajun people were mixing every kind of vegetable they could get.
Can you hold that for a second? We have to take a quick break. Okay. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Jeffrey Rothfeder about his book McElhaney's Gold, and what we're doing is taking a bottle of Tabasco and opening up and pouring it on the table and seeing what's in there. Right back after these messages, please do stay tuned. Hey, we're back. Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain. We're talking with Jeff Rothfeder about his book McElhaney's Gold, and we're quite literally or figuratively taking a bottle of Tabasco sauce and opening it up and pouring it out on the table, and we're looking to see what's in there, and there's a lot more in there than peppers and vinegar and salt. There's the history of a country and a people, and that's what we're playing with right now. We're looking at the time before the Civil War, when the Cajuns came down to Louisiana and taught the rich folk down there about spices and how to mix things together and how to make jambalaya and things like that. Right, Jeff?
Yeah, and with their food, their one-pot food, they would throw in all kinds of vegetables and anything they could catch out in the fields, and they threw in a lot of peppers because down in Louisiana a lot of peppers were grown and they were growing wild down there, and so the interesting thing about their mixing of the foods more than let's say the French legitimate recipes as it were is that you began to see how by mixing chili peppers within a big stew you softened the impact, the heat of the chili pepper. And so that got people to liking it even more because now you could see it in a recipe where, you know, you just drop a little bit in and it just changes the whole flavor and doesn't even make it too hot that you can't enjoy it. You know, there are obviously great Cajun-related cooks now like Paul Prudhomme,
right,
who is the classic example, who says he always mixes one or two little drops of Tabasco sauce in almost everything he cooks. Specifically Tabasco sauce, even though there are other hot sauces. So that definitely came down from the Cajun tradition of using all kinds of different things in the pot, and that brought the chili pepper into ascendancy in Louisiana.
Then what about the Tabasco sauce? Now there's the legend of how the Tabasco sauce came into being, and then there's the reality. So take us through the legend first, because it's sexier than the reality.
Right. Well, The McElhaney's McElhaney himself, Edmund McElhaney, who started the Tabasco Company, he married into the Avery family before the Civil War, and they owned a huge sugar plantation on Avery Island. And when the Civil War, and Avery Island, by the way, is a salt dome, and it literally is salt that comes up out of the Gulf of Mexico. The salt the size of Mount Everest, actually, that it sits on a mountain that big of salt. And so when the Civil War came, the Union soldiers took over Avery Island right away.
Because salt was very precious back then,
exactly,
as a preservative, correct?
That's right. And they needed access to that, especially if they were going to be working sort of the back channel of the Mississippi down in the south. And so the McElhaneys and the Averys got thrown off the island, and they wandered. They went to Texas and stayed there for a few years. And so the way McElhaney originally told the story was that as he was leaving the island, he threw some peppers into the ground and his sort of his last stand as he ran away.
Jack and the Beanstalk.
That's right, exactly. And when he returned, lo and behold, the island was destroyed. It had been burnt to the ground by the Union. All the homes were destroyed, but the pepper plant survived. And so based on that, it was sort of providential as he saw it. And so he started playing with the pepper plants and started seeing what he could do with it. And sure enough, pepper sauce emerged out of that.
Now that's a great story, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it shows McElhaney's skill in creating sort of an aura and a myth around his product, which is what he very much tried to do all the time in terms of creating Tabasco sauce as a brand that you can't forget.
Now, were there other Tabasco sauces in that era?
Well, there were, before McElhinney's Tabasco sauce, which came out in 1867, there was a great gourmet party giver named Monzel White down in Louisiana, down in New Orleans. He was a great plantation owner, and he used to throw these wonderful parties where he'd try out different kinds of food, and he created a Tabasco sauce from chili peppers. He created basically his own pepper sauce. This would be in the 1840s or so, and people loved it so much that they wanted to buy it. And so he gave some to the local groceries to sell. But it was all very, very local. It was all Louisiana, mostly New Orleans, and that's where probably Edmund McElhinney learned about this possibility. Edmund McElhinney never told anybody.
So after the Civil War, they were essentially broke, looking for some way of rebuilding their fortunes. And rather than going back to the plantation economy, which was no longer there, he found some peppers or found a pepper business.
Well, yes, exactly. His story about the peppers growing providentially did not happen, but what did happen is he took a trip to New Orleans looking for work, actually, because he had been a banker, and found that there was no work to be had. I mean, New Orleans was basically in lockdown. The Union soldiers were walking the streets and guarding it. And so he came back from that trip, though, and this is the part that we really don't know exactly what happened there, but he came back from that trip with some peppers and with the idea to plant them and just see what happens. And from that, he did create Tabasco sauce. He bought the Tabasco peppers in New Orleans, the original ones. The other interesting piece of this, though, and I love this part of the story, is that you know what we call focus groups today. When you're trying out new products, you test it out in front of a group of people. Well, his focus group were a bunch of ex-slaves who had decided not to leave Avery Island, even though they were emancipated. They didn't know what to do with their lives, and they had only lived on Avery Island, so they hung around for work. And McElhinney basically gave them work as being a focus group and asking them, you know, do you like this pepper sauce? What can I do to make it better? And they come from the Caribbean and knew good pepper sauce.
Uh-huh.
And so they essentially are the ones who created the taste that we know of Tabasco sauce is these ex-slaves telling him about how to make the flavor better and better, how much vinegar to add, how much salt, and so on. And so it grew out of that.
And so when you go to New Orleans today, you know, you go into the little tourist stores and they have shelves of, you know, all of these colorful labeled pepper sauces, but there's only one Tabasco sauce.
Mm. Yeah, and that's a great part of the McElhinney story, and again of the original owner, Edmund McElhinney's genius, is that, you know, at a time when nobody really understood branding, we're talking about the late 1800s now, McElhinney did, and he understood that if he owned the name Tabasco, he then owned the product. He owned the market, essentially, in that product. So he trademarked, and they had some trademark wars over this, but he ultimately trademarked the name Tabasco, so only he and his company can use it.
At the time, there were other sauces, Tabasco sauces, mm-hmm. correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there were even Heinz and Campbell's. For example, were putting out Tabasco sauces, and there were loads of smaller brands. They all had imitated McElhinney, but he quietly got the name and told the courts, they lied to the courts, the McElhinneys did, by telling the courts that they were the only ones that ever used the name Tabasco, and by doing that, they could get their trademark.
So back then, there was a 10-year window. If anybody had been using the name Tabasco, then the McElhinneys would not have been granted a trademark, correct?
That's right. That's exactly right. And so they had to stipulate to the courts that no one else had ever used it. And the courts accepted it. Now, part of the reason they accepted it is that this is Louisiana, and the McElhinneys had a lot of power in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And so so they used their power. They had a lot of quartz in their pockets, as it were, mm-hmm. and so they used that to get the name to themselves.
So those who complained and saying, well, we've been using this name Tabasco sauce for years and years and years, mm-hmm. nobody was there to listen to their complaints.
Exactly.
Right.
Now, but it's important
I'm glad things have changed in New Orleans.
Barely.
Yeah, right.
But it's important to understand that owning the name of a place, now Tabasco is the name of a state in Mexico.
Right.
And owning the name of a place, they are the only company to own the name of a place, to have a trademark to it. It would be as if I would put out, you know, potatoes
Montana,
from Idaho and try to get a trademark on the name Idaho.
Right.
You can't do it. they are the only company that's been able to do it. And but because they have done that, of course, they have owned their market. And even with so many other products out there that say pepper sauce on them today, none of them can say Tabasco sauce. None of them can even say Tabasco chilies in their list of ingredients. And so by doing that, you know, you essentially can continue to own a market. And so their market share at this point, even though, as I said, there are probably 20, 30, 40 other pepper sauces, their market share is still 35 to 40%, well ahead of anybody else
out there. Of the world, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about Tabasco sauce. We're opening a bottle and pouring it out and seeing what's in it, tasting it a little bit and looking into its history. We have Jeffrey Rothfeder, who is the author of McElhaney's Gold, a wonderful read about Tabasco sauce, and what a history. We wish you please do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, I bet you've had a drop or two on some of your foods. I can remember back in the Navy after the ship is out at sea for a couple of weeks, the food gets pretty terrible. And a little bit of Tabasco sauce on the food, and you're in business. So that's what we're talking about today, is that Tabasco sauce. We've got Jeffrey Rothfeder, the author of McElhaney's Gold, with us, and we're talking about the McElhaney family, which owns and has owned for 114 years the Tabasco sauce company. I did a radio show from Soledad Prison, Jeffrey, and I was doing a piece on the prison horticulture program, and I asked the guard that was taking me around why the convicts weren't growing food. You know, I was thinking it's nice to have a lawn and some flowers and whatnot, but gee whiz, why aren't they growing food? And he said, think about it. If you were to grow some chili peppers, people would kill you for them. And he's probably right.
True.
Because when you get into those institutions, the food gets pretty bland.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the antidote to institutional foods, isn't it? This Tabasco sauce.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's why the military carries it in their packs. It's the only thing that can make military food taste good. But it's interesting to say that because it's really clear that of all the condiments, and in my research, I talked to a lot of different food preparers as well as people that gourmets and people that just love food.
Paul Prudhomme.
It's really clear that of all the condiments, take mustard and ketchup and so on, Tabasco sauce really stands out in people's minds. I mean, there's a real loyalty to that product and a real love for it that I was frankly somewhat surprised about. I didn't realize how deeply people really liked to use Tabasco sauce and on how many things. And of course, in other places around the world, it's very popular in Japan, for example, and they put it on literally everything. I mean, they put it on chop suey, and they put it on sushi, and anywhere you can put some kind of sauce, they put it there.
And it's Tabasco sauce. It's not other kinds of hot sauce. It's Tabasco sauce. And the reason it's Tabasco sauce is that one family has figured out how to capture and hold a name and not let anybody else use it, correct?
Right. And the thing about that is, too, and again, there were a lot of court cases over this, and there was actually, even after the big companies like Heinz and Campbell had quit the market, because once McElhaney got their first trademark approval, a lot of these other companies just bowed out. They just didn't want to go through the whole legal hassle of it. But there was one guy who used to work for the McElhaneys, a guy named Trappe, down in New Iberia, Louisiana, who started making his own, and for about 30 to 40 years fought tooth and nail against the McElhaneys, all the way to the Supreme Court, back down to appellate courts, up and back, about that name, to be able to use the word Tabasco. And boy, in the end, the McElhaneys, the power they have in Louisiana over the courts, which is significant, it really is, won out. And Trappe basically had to go out of business because mm-hmm. he couldn't afford to do business in any other way.
Now, a trademark, unlike a patent, goes on forever.
That's right.
Patent is good for 50 years, a trademark, you own it forever. It is you.
Right, exactly. And so, again, you have to view it as, again, very impressively as McElhaney genius because, there were a lot of major products And, you know, there are great sort of stories, you know, you tell about them in business schools and so on.
What bad?
A lot of major products that lost their names because they didn't protect it. I mean,
they become generic.
Exactly. The obvious one, you know, Bayer aspirin. Bayer invented aspirin, but they let every single pharmacy make their own kind of aspirin. And so when they went for the trademark, the court said, you can't have it. I mean, everybody makes aspirin. You know, and Escalator is another one. I mean, you can go through the list. There's just so many of them. But only a handful, and we're talking, again, late 1800s, early 1900s, only a handful of companies knew the value. And, you know, they're companies like Coca-Cola and Kleenex and McElhaney, you know, and that's to me, that's the interesting part, is here's this little family business that really got it, that, you know, make this brand stand out, be its own name, and you'll succeed beyond all the others.
Well, let's talk about the family then. I mean, this is not a corporation, a public corporation. This is a closed corporation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an interesting setup. The way Edmund McElhaney, the founder, set it up is that every single heir of his gets a piece of this business. And so at first, of course, it was just his children, and there were some sons and a couple of daughters, and so they got pieces. And, of course, then you extend out and out and out as you go through the generations, and now there are 200 people.
And everybody wants
country.
To be part of the McElhaney family because?
That's right, because they're all, you know, cousins and...
Right.
And, you know, all offshoots somehow of the original husband and wife team. Now, what that means, by the way, is all of these people collect dividends, and many of them, you know, and I spoke to many of them, don't live on Avery Island, for one thing.
Right.
Many of them live far away from
there. Well, there's 200 of them now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you put 200 people from the same family on one little island, it would get really interesting really fast.
That's true. Many of them live in places like, you know, California, Connecticut, Michigan. I mean, they're all over the country. And so, but they collect, and some of them are collecting well over $1 million a year in dividends. Some are collecting $400,000 or $500,000 a year. But this is real money coming in because you're talking about $250 million in revenue divided up amongst these people.
And they say the profit margin on a bottle of Tabasco sauce is what, roughly 25%?
Yeah, now it's 25%. It actually has been higher. It's been 35-40%, and the reason for that is, and there again is just a way that these guys have done business that's so different from others. I mean, you know, think about it. You hardly have ever seen an advertisement for Tabasco sauce, certainly not on television,
right?
And not in print ads. And you'd expect to see that. I mean, we see advertisements for ketchup, and ketchup is basically a commodity product that you can buy for 89 cents. You know.
Because nobody owns the name ketchup, right?
That's right, exactly. And anyone can make it. And so, you know, so Heinz has had to, in fact, as we know from their ads, show that they're a little thicker than the other guys,
right,
and that's
right.
Why they don't plop out of the, you know, the bottle well enough, right, and all that. But the McElhaney's haven't had to do that. And so they've basically grown by word of mouth, by people who love the product telling other people about it, and of course getting very good placement in stores because they are the only Tabasco sauce. And so think of all the savings you can have as a company if you don't have to advertise, for one thing. You're doing very little promotion, very little you know, pushing of your product.
You're the only one. There's nobody to fight against.
In doing that, you know, your margins can be really, really high because, you know, you're making a lot more profit out of every dollar that comes in. So they have really figured it out really well. I mean, they've got a genius about them, a business genius that a lot of other family businesses don't have. And in fact, here's another sort of interesting fact that I came across, that only 0.003%, so this is way below 1%, of all family businesses survive to the fourth generation. And the McElhaney's, of course, are one of them, and they're going into their fifth generation. In fact, fewer than half of family businesses survive into the second generation because usually when the founder goes, that's kind of the end of it. You know, the kids are off doing something else. And so it just shows really what a unique business these guys
are. And we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, I want to talk about that family genius. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Jeffrey Ruffeater, author of McElhaney's Gold, the story of the Tabasco sauce. There's only one Tabasco sauce, and that's it. no more. There's only one in all the world. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Jeffrey Rothfeder about his look into the bottle of Tabasco sauce that's sitting on the table in front of you. It turned out to be a book called McElhaney's Gold, and it's the story of the McElhaney family, which owns the Tabasco sauce brand, Lock, Stock, and Barrel. A family-owned business, a true family-owned business. No outsiders, correct, Jeffrey?
That's correct.
So through the years, I mean, if you see a family business, and there's one here in the Central California coast that's a few generations old. It's the S. Martinelli and Company, which makes sparkling apple cider.
Right.
But they don't own cider.
Right, right, exactly. And you know, very few businesses have had the foresight to understand how you have to brand your product, and that's what the McElhaney's have done so well. And again, the other thing is, by doing that, you don't have to advertise as much and so on, and so you can keep your prices down, your expenses down quite a bit. Now, it's interesting. There is a tension to this story that makes it even more interesting now, in a sense. And this is sort of where my book ends up on. So what's going on today?
Well, don't end it yet, because we still have a few more minutes. Take us back to the succession of owners, or the succession of chief executive officers. How do you pass that intelligence from one generation to the next and keep a company going? I mean, granted, they have the name,
right?
They have the product, nobody else has it. So I guess you'd have to be a real fool to mess that one up, right?
Well, but many companies have messed up great products over the years. What they've done so well, I think living on an island is different than living any other place. Now, I grew up on an island, but it's Manhattan Island, and so it's quite a different kind of place. But when you live on a small island, there's certain kind of insular attitude develops. Here is a family business on an island, so they only talk to each other, and the focus of their lives, and I talk a lot about this throughout the book, was the product. Everything they did on that island had to do with the product, you know, and so you really, what I think you end up passing down from one generation to the next is how to do business right, and how to keep doing business the old-fashioned way. There's a very conservative streak in this family, and it's paid off well for them. The one factory.
How does that play out, though, when you say there's a real conservative streak? What does that mean?
Well, in terms of their business model, they've been very, very conservative. In the late 1800s, for example, and this is a real good illustration, a lot of companies went out of business because in the Industrial Revolution, they would buy more and more new machines to make things, produce things faster and faster. In fact, Heinz actually went out of business 7 years after they started. They went bankrupt because they had overbought machines.
Right.
Then they came back in business.
Something
five
you
years
see
later.
A lot of farmers doing too.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely, exactly.
And in good times,
sort of boom and bust mentality.
Yeah, in good times you rent out and go into Hawk, and then in bad times you sit there going, I blew it.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Yeah. And so you've got these huge loans you have to pay off. Now the McElhaney's never did that. They would only buy things as they would need it, as the business grew big enough to, let's say, need a little more automation or to expand the factory one way or the other, things like that. And so they did things really step by step, very slowly and very conservatively, and they still do it that way. I mean, even now, you know, they've started putting out a few more products, a chipotle sauce, you know, a habanero sauce, but not very much. And even those products, they don't promote very much. They just don't want to get into 10 different kinds of business lines.
Right.
It's just not their approach.
Why should you when you own the world, right?
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say. They've got this one product that sells so well, and it supports them, so why do you need to do anything else with that?
Tell us about some of the characters that have run the McElhaney company.
Well, it's a great group. You know, Edmund McElhaney was the founder, and as I said, he sort of set up this conservative streak and this only do what you need to do. And so his sons, John Avery McElhaney, for instance, was a rough rider with Teddy Roosevelt, and he took over the business right afterwards. But the big player was the man they called Mr. Ned, who ran the business from 1905 to about 1950.
That's through the period of the trademark then.
He was the one that won the trademark. That's right, through the trademark wars, and then, of course, through the Great Depression, kept the business alive through all of that. And what Mr. Ned did, though, he was a worldwide traveler and wrote these great books on Eskimo dialects that are still considered the best books on that subject today. I mean, he traveled to places that nobody had ever traveled to in those days, like the Arctic. And he also saved the egret from extinction by taking these birds that were being killed for their plumes,
right,
and just taking them one at a time, putting them on Avery Island and giving them a home. I mean, it's just an amazing figure. But the other thing he did was he built a company town on Avery Island, and where he had all the workers, at least all the factory workers, living on the island itself, gave them homes, basically free homes, and in exchange for cheap labor. I call it in the book a postbellum plantation,
sure,
because basically he recreated plantation life,
sure,
on the island. And
economic slavery, I guess. Right?
Exactly, and he was a big figure, you know, and. So when he died, it was amazing. In his obituary, they called him the Great White Father in his obituary, which, you know, what other CEO gets that name put on them?
Probably not too many.
Right, exactly. So it's a great crowd of people. You know, each generation produced, and by the way, right after Mr. Ned, there was this Tabasco Mac took over the company, and he had worldwide fame as one of the greatest sharpshooters in the Marines,
huh,
and in World War II. And so stories would come back from the front with stories about the legendary Tabasco Mac.
Gonna have to take a quick break, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're talking about Tabasco sauce with Jeffrey Rothfeder, the author of McElhaney's Gold. Do stay tuned. We will be right back after these messages, and we'll talk about today's company. Right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
And so when you go into the little diner, what do you see on the table there next to the salt and pepper? Almost guaranteed it's going to be a little jar of Tabasco sauce. There is but one company that can make Tabasco sauce. That is the McElhaney Company of Avery Island, Louisiana. And started, 114 years ago?
Even more, it was 140 years ago.
140 years ago. Mm-hmm. One company, one family survives in business for 140 years. So what does it look like today?
Well, there's a crisis point going on today, and that's where basically my book ends and tells this final story, is that with 200 people around the country having a piece of the business because they're all Edmund McElhaney's heirs, and the family going to the fifth generation of running the business, there are more and more family members who are beginning to think, what do we do with this company now in the future? Because as new people get born with every birth, they're sharing their revenue with somebody else.
Right.
And, you know, the next generation will probably have 250 people.
It's like
there.
A pyramid, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so the issue is being raised by some of the younger people to perhaps sell the business. Now, there are standing offers for the Tabasco business by companies like Heinz and Campbell's and General Foods of anywhere from $1 billion to $2 billion. That's billion with a B. And so they could get a very, very big payday that they could share among the McElhinney family and, you know, move off the business. And a lot of these people, the younger people who are sort of pushing this along, don't care about the product. They don't have the product in their DNA. You know, they don't, many of them haven't even visited
it's like pennies from heaven, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so they, you know, they just don't feel the same way about it. And they're thinking, you know, let's get our payday and run. But the older members of the family, and certainly the ones that live near Avery Island or on the island, don't want to do that. And so there is this tension now going on within the family, not to mention the fact that, you know, there's lots more competition than they've ever had in the past 5 to 10 years or even 10 to 20 years mm-hmm. of all the new Tabasco sauces that have come on the
market.
Sorry, I didn't say Tabasco sauces.
There was a slip, right?
That have come on the market.
So they have to call them pepper sauces. They can't call them anything else.
They can't call them Tabasco. Yeah. Exactly. And that's actually the first time I've ever made that mistake. so with all the new competition, you know, they're facing a lot of different kinds of issues that they didn't face before. Like, do they have to start advertising? I mean, so that they can compete against the cheaper pepper sauce. And there are cheaper ones in the local grocery.
Of course.
Or the chili head pepper sauces, as I call them, the ones that are hotter and that the kind of the hipper people like to taste, you know. And mm-hmm. So there are all these issues facing them, and I don't know where they're going to end up. I don't have a crystal ball.
Well,
let me ask you
this then. As a business writer for many years, what business lesson would you take, you know, and lay on the table for all of us out here who want to start the next McElhinney company?
Well, I think for all family businesses and all small businesses, the thing to do is to, as the phrase is, you know, stick to your knitting. I mean, that's what the McElhinneys have shown us more than anything. You know, there are a lot of companies, certainly in California and Silicon Valley and so on, that we know that started up in the dot-com boom and all that, and they just started going into all kinds of other things that they could do, anything to sort of expand. It costs too much money, and then you end up losing in the kind of boom and bust mentality. The McElhinneys never had that, and you know they've shown that innovation can grow out of the product that you have. You know, you just can keep making it better and better.
And that's a great lesson to learn, folks. This has been The Food Chain with Michael Olson. You've been talking to with Jeffrey Rothfeder about the red jar on the coffee shop table. And the book is McElhinney's Gold, a fun read, a great read. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.